Of course, the bottom line goal of every crusade was the number of people who responded to Graham's call. Though from his early days he had an uncanny gift for the invitation. His colleagues acknowledged that, especially since he achieved world renown, several quite unmiraculous factors entered into Graham's unprecedented success at drawing in the net. Gavin Reed admitted that Billy gets good results because more uncommitted people come to his meetings than is true with other evangelists. He is an aim, and all gave much credit to the planting and cultivation that went on before the harvester hit town with his evangelistic combine. In giving the invitation, Graham often described the decision to come forward as a difficult one. That can be the case, of course, particularly in foreign countries where Christianity is a minority religion, and becoming a Christian may involve painful breaks with one's family and friends. But for most inquirers, the decision to walk down the aisle is relatively easy. Indeed, in some cases, it is easier than staying put. Everyone who has been to a crusade service or watched one on television, which almost certainly includes most of those in attendance, knows that hundreds of others would be streaming to the front and that no embarrassing emotional demonstrations would be expected or even tolerated. Further, those who came with a friend as part of the Operation Andrew program surely understood that failure to respond would be a bit of a disappointment to the friendly folk who got them a ticket and saved them a place on the bus, and would make the trip home less enjoyable than if they had behaved as hoped, as some of the other invitees were almost certainly likely to have done. Such pressures were not enormous, but they were real, and they helped swell inquirer ranks. The inevitable success of the invitation could not help but have an exhilarating effect on the counselors who assisted inquirers in clarifying and confirming their decision. Evangelical Christians feel they should be leading others to Christ, but many find it difficult to talk to their friends and relatives about salvation out of fear they will be thought intrusive or odd. But at the crusade, they talked with people who, by their complete willingness to buy what is being sold, furnished them with the opportunity to do precisely what they thought they should be doing, with an almost perfect guarantee of success. This happy experience almost surely bolstered their confidence and willingness to approach others once the crusade ended. In a diffuse and invisible way, this process was repeated a few weeks later, when the crusade was aired on television and viewers were given opportunity to respond to his preaching by calling a number on their screens. More than a fourth of the 12,000 or so people who called one of BGEA's 8 regional telephone centers during the week of Graham's quarterly television specials made some kind of decision for Christ. And as at the live crusades, some of the greatest benefits accrued to the counselors themselves. Terry Wilkin, a team member who worked with the telephone ministry from its inception, observed that nothing increases faith like trying to give it away. Every night, counselors go out of here several feet off the ground talking about the blessings they have received from participating. When you look at it from their perspective, it's probably the easiest kind of witnessing you could do. As one who long compared himself to the harvester, who reaps what others have sown and cultivated, Billy Graham recognized that the harvest, to be of significant use to any but scavengers, must be gathered into barns and protected against hostile elements. By his own criterion, then, it is disciple-making rather than decision-counting that must serve as the ultimate measure of an evangelist's accomplishments. Neither he nor his associates pretended that every person who comes forward or calls a counseling center is making a meaningful response. When one watches a father shrug his shoulders and shuffle down the aisle after his grown daughter tells him she is disgusted with him for holding back, that was the whole point in coming, for God's sake. Or sees 2 prepubescent boys poke one another and toss their caps in the air as they skip across the stadium infield toward the counseling area. Or listen to a teenage girl tell her friend, "Well, if I can, you can. There's nothing to it." One comes to understand that not every decision flows from the deepest wellsprings of heart or mind. Graham long admitted that people come for different reasons, and that some of the reasons are quite superficial. "We never call them converts," he said early in his career. "We much prefer to call them inquirers. Only God knows when or if a man is truly converted. Many come forward in our meetings who are seekers but not finders. As Graham and his team always graciously admitted, the trip down the aisle is just one segment of a journey on a path that many others have helped prepare, and on which the seeker had already started to walk. "I'm not sure I've ever led a soul to Christ," he has said. "There are so many factors. A mother, a Sunday school teacher, a preacher who has been slugging it out for years. I simply come along as a way shower. I say, 'Do you see that door? That's the way in.'" Of those who made first-time decisions in Graham's crusades, a small minority, but still a substantial number, were doubtless truly won to Christ from a stance of antagonism, indifference, or apathy, as a sampling of the mail received in Minneapolis clearly reveals. For the majority, however, particularly in America, the decision they made is one they would have made at some point in their lives, even if Billy Graham had not come to town, when they reached a certain age, when peers in their Sunday school class responded, when pressure from their spouses reached a sufficient level, or at a revival held by a lesser evangelist. Similarly, some rededicators were genuine reprobates, dragooned into the stadium against their will, or perhaps come to scoff, and moved instead by terror or love to repent and turn from their evil ways. Far more were people of tender conscience, who feared they had not done all they might to win souls, or who were more concerned with their own affairs than about their Father's business, or who felt guilty because they sometimes daydreamed during the pastor's sermon. But like the decision to attend college or to marry, a decision to say, "I am now ready to assume the responsibility of living as a Christian," was not less momentous simply because it was an expected part of one's life agenda. Similarly, if a substantial number of church folk, whose light had begun to dim, were plugged back into their systems on a high voltage line, the crusade performed an important function for both the individual and the systems in question. While the great stadium crusades remained the hallmark of his ministry, and while he drew crowds to them for a far longer period than any other evangelist has ever managed to do, it is indisputably the case that Billy Graham magnified his voice and multiplied his words tremendously by his ability and willingness to use modern mass media. To the end, he made use of the two media that served him longest, print and radio. In 1990, his My Answer column ran in over 100 newspapers, but that was far below its peak during the 1950s and 1960s. Aides insist he tried to check them to approve of their content, but conceded, as the column itself noted once each year, that staff writers did the actual writing. No one seemed to think the column was living up to its potential. Even Fred Dienert, who was usually relentless in his determination to put a positive spin on anything connected with the ministry, admitted that something should be done. "There's an opportunity to handle it in a way that meets the needs of people today. For example, if you talk about divorce, you're talking about the whole country. It's in every church in America. Families breaking up, loneliness, singles, people who are hurting and crying. You can't just give them a verse about casting all of your cares on Jesus because he'll take care of you. It would probably take a full-time crew to do a better column, but it could grow again, because nobody has the audience Billy has." Rather than wait for a newspaper squib to hit upon their particular problem, those who wanted a fuller and more satisfying answer to a specific question could write directly to Graham at his Minneapolis headquarters. Correct spelling and a precise address were unnecessary. The letter collection contains missives sent to Billy Graham, Minneapolis, Minnesoldium, Reverend Billy Graham, Many Applause, Many Sorrow, Los Angeles, Mr. Billy Graham, Baptist Church's Preacher, Will You Find Him Out, Please, New York, Billy Graham, World Citizen, Care of American Government, and the Reverend Billy Graham, "Dear Mr. Postman, I don't know the address of Reverend Graham, but please try and get this letter to him. It really is important. Love, Linda." In marked contrast to other well-known media ministers who not only claim to read every letter they receive, but authorize responses in which a computer has slugged in the correspondent's name in a display of ersatz intimacy, Graham freely admitted he did not and could not read more than a tiny fraction of his mail. Moreover, the responses were signed by the people who actually prepared them. Prepare is often more accurate than write. Ralph Williams, director of BGEA's Christian Guidance Department, explained how his staff of approximately 25 men and women handled most of the more than 200,000 inquiries people addressed to Billy Graham each year. Large notebooks contained standardized responses on a host of subjects. Each sentence and verse of Scripture were numbered so that a male counselor could construct an appropriate response simply by typing the proper codes on a computer. Most of the topics were routine, of the sort a secular therapist might face: anxiety, bereavement, birth control, drugs, jealousy, marriage, smoking, and war. Others made it clear that this was a religious enterprise. Age of accountability, Bible translations, daughter wants to marry non-Christian, frequent writers. We keep a file of people who just write to us again and again so we can refer back to previous letters. Heaven, description of, Jehovah's Witnesses, ministry, call to, non-Christian friends for children. Parents, how to deal with child's waywardness, perilous times, poem, acknowledgement, we get a lot of poems, purgatory, Sabbath, and witnessing. The responses were not quotations from Billy Graham, but Williams felt they were pretty much abreast of how Billy feels. We've built them up over the years and feel we're in tune with him and his thoughts and position on these topics, whether it's in the area of theology or social action or whatever. When a topic loomed large in the public consciousness, for example, abortion, AIDS, cults, herpes, or as in 1987, television evangelism, the counseling department typically prepared a few paragraphs, a special letter, or even a complete pamphlet on the subject. Sometimes such letters call for a delicate balancing act. We are inclined to be a bit ambiguous on AIDS, Williams noted. We feel it's important to give a sense of hope. While some are saying AIDS is a judgment from God, we just say that our sin as a nation brings its own harvest. When an inquiry was too complex or sensitive for a prepackaged response, it was forwarded to an advanced counseling reader, typically a minister or counselor with more experience than the first tier of readers. Advanced counselors also had notebooks to draw on, but could adapt the responses to fit a particular situation. Regular counselors were not permitted to deviate from the printed responses. When it appeared that correspondents needed something more than a one- or two-page letter, the counselors could refer them to specialists near their homes. "We have a list of helping people around the country," Williams explained. "We know something about their background, their specialty, and their staff, so that we are sure they have a Christian perspective. It may be a church or pastoral counselor or a Christian who specializes in crisis intervention. There are so many people who are without purpose, who don't know why they should live and think they don't want to live, who are just awash in life and can't find help from pastors who believe the answer is simply to tell them to have more faith." In August 1987, BGEA's operations chief, John Quartz, noted that 27 women in the male division had answered 17,000 letters during the previous 60 days. "The people who wrote don't know those ladies," he admitted. "The only name they know is Billy Graham. They write because they want him to tell them whether they should buy a house or move into a rest home down the street or whatever. We can't answer all those questions, but at least we can go back to them with some kind of love, care, and concern." Decision still rolls along as the world's most widely distributed religious magazine, with 2 million copies mailed to subscribers in 163 countries. And Graham continues to reach millions through his many books. In 1972, the Saturday Evening Post quoted him as saying, "I do all of my own writing." The quote may have been accurate, but the reality was not. And Graham was said to be quite sensitive about his extensive reliance on researchers and ghostwriters. That sensitivity ebbed noticeably, so that he became quite open about the help he received from others, maintaining only that he participated actively in his writing projects, and at the least, carefully examined anything that went out under his name to make certain it accurately represented his beliefs and opinions. John Akers, who helped with several books, explained that Graham provided the essence of his books and others helped fill in the outlines, including Ruth, who has a great gift for illustration. The Hour of Decision was still being aired weekly over 690 stations in 1990. including 151 international stations, broadcasting 6 foreign language versions of the program. But the Graham team had come to view it less as a prime evangelistic tool than as a vehicle for keeping the ministry's prayer partners informed as to what the evangelist is doing. In addition to its radio program, BGEA also owns and operates 2 radio stations, one near Montreat and one in Honolulu. "We didn't want to be in that business," Graham said, "but we are in it. It's never really been an interest of mine, and I don't give it top priority." T.W. Wilson, who monitored the stations, agreed with that assessment. "When a station's going real good," he said with a chuckle, "it's our station. When there are problems, it's T's station." Graham apparently had a similar lack of passion for making films. According to John Akers, "the film ministry has always driven him crazy. Basically, it's an exercise in deficit financing." Worldwide Pictures became the largest producer and distributor of Christian films in the world. An estimated 150 million people had seen at least one of the films, and at least 1.5 million have made decisions for Christ at film showings. Expense and concern over diminished effectiveness led to a 1988 decision to close the Burbank studios and relocate production facilities in Minneapolis. Caught, a 1986 film about drugs and a boy's search for his natural father, did not draw well in the United States, but worldwide more than 600,000 people saw it during the first 2 months after it was released. Far less than had been expected, but not an insignificant number. And Dave Barr, Worldwide's international representative, ventured that this one may do for the international program what The Restless Ones did for the United States. "We think it's going to be a great blessing." Radio gave Billy Graham his first truly national exposure, and films legitimated the use of that medium by people who regarded cinema as the devil's tool, but it was television that kept him in the public eye. Other preachers appear on television more often, but none used the medium more efficiently and effectively than Graham. One key to his success was the decision not to attempt the weekly Sunday morning program. As years of Nielsen and Arbitron ratings have demonstrated, the audiences for his programs, usually aired in groups of 3 on a quarterly basis, were far larger than those for the syndicated Sunday programs of other religious broadcasters. This larger audience also appeared to contain far more unchurched people than did the Sunday shows. The 1978 Gallup study, The Unchurched American, for example, discovered that 11% of the 61 million unchurched in this country said they had watched Billy Graham on television. The only other preacher to attract more than 4% was Oral Roberts, then also using primetime specials in addition to his Sunday morning program. The audience of the Sunday programs produced by Roberts, Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, and their colleagues appeared to be composed primarily of faithful church members, which is why most of the programs aired before 10 o'clock. If they came on later, their audience would be in church. If a program was geared to teach, nurture, and encourage believers, early Sunday morning would be the best time for it. If it aimed to reach the lost and the lukewarm, it would be hard to think of a less promising time slot. Since Graham's compelling mission was to present his message to people who are not already hearing it several times a week, he chose to run his programs during prime-time early evening hours. Despite the success Graham's quarterly specials enjoyed and the near-automatic ease with which they could be produced, there had been increasing pressure to modernize the format in the later years. TV director Roger Flessing put the matter bluntly. "We have a good news show with an hour on the Anchorman. I'd like to see more graphics, file footage, other things that would illustrate points Mr. Graham is making. Jesus was a visual teacher. Look at the lilies. Look at the fishermen. Look at the farmer. Look at the. With television, we have the capacity to look, but we're not doing it. We're right here just looking at the preacher, and we can't even be as visual as we'd like with what we've got." Pointing to a shot of the choir on one of the monitors arrayed before him on the control panel in the television truck, he said, "Most church choirs look better than this. We don't really try to shoot tights, because when you zoom in, these people don't know what they're singing or they're three beats off, or one person is just gung-ho and the person next to her doesn't even know what's going on. A church choir is more disciplined. Ted Dienert, Fred's son, Graham's son-in-law, and TV producer beginning in 1982, agreed with Flessing. Sitting in a hotel restaurant one morning during the 1987 Columbia Crusade, he said, "There's a constant effort to try to figure out what will hook the secular audience. The Crusades haven't changed for 20 years, and the TV format has been virtually the same. We are integrating new elements into that format because the viewer's taste and sophistication has changed, and we need to keep up with that. At times, maybe I get a little avant-garde for the ministry, but my job is to see if we can get the job done more effectively. I don't care whether I like it, or Cliff likes it, or even whether Billy Graham likes it. We want to be sensitive, of course, but my goal is that audience out there." To create a more appealing product, Dienert and Flessing altered the old practice of filming only three crusade services and hoping for the best, with editing limited to cutting a few dead spots here and there to squeeze the program into a one-hour time frame. They began to film all the services and used only those segments they felt would make the most effective package. A few weeks after the Denver Crusade, for example, the two men and other members of their crew, armed with stacks of film and thick notebooks, met at Third Coast Studios in Austin, Texas, to piece together the master videotape they would send to a duplicator, who would make 350 copies to be distributed to television stations in the United States and Canada. With 7 or 8 nights of entertainers and testifiers, it was relatively simple to come up with a good mix that fit the time constraints for a particular program, and to edit out anything that might be jarring to the viewing audience. On this occasion, someone noted that the sky was dark while Bev Shea sang, but light when Graham got up to preach afterward. "We tried to keep the songs with the night of the sermon," Dienert explained, "but Bev blew the words that night, and his segment was taken from another service." When it came time to plug in Graham's sermon, Dienert and his technicians referred to notebooks that contained transcripts of every word spoken on the videotape with a precise indication of the time each sentence took. The evangelist's misspeaks were always excised. "Either we or someone else points out mistakes, and we clip them," an assistant producer explained. "If he misquotes Time magazine or says the King of Spain died last week, that comes out. Or anything controversial that comes out." Jokes and stories Graham had repeated for years also came out, as did meandering trips down what the TV crew called rabbit trails. The editors might also cover up such minor irregularities as reference to "my fourth point," when no third point was ever made. After the sermon's obvious errors and weak spots were eliminated and its length set, it was strengthened even further by skillful use of reaction shots of the crowd that could be matched with various parts of the sermon. By the time the program aired a few weeks later, Billy Graham had become a better preacher than he actually was on the night he delivered the sermon in person, and those who watched the program could see that he held the crowd in the palm of his hand. Graham's policy of appearing quarterly instead of weekly may have won him a larger audience, but it also saddled the Dienerts with a tougher task than that faced by the media representatives for other television ministers. Instead of negotiating long-term contracts for a regular weekly time slot, the Dienerts and other Bennett Company agents had to wrangle anew with station representatives every time they wanted to put Graham on the air. Partly as a measure to save money, the Bennett Company moved Graham's programs onto UHF stations in many cities and in some markets dropped local stations entirely, relying on the Turner Cable Network to provide a sufficient audience. Economic pressures also led to a dropping of the foreign language programs that were once a standard component of Graham's television outreach. Despite these cutbacks, there was no sign that Graham or his colleagues had serious misgivings about television's efficacy as an evangelistic tool. A major advantage of television, of course, is that it enabled Billy Graham to do what he could not possibly do in person. Larry Ross elaborated on that obvious but important fact. "Television," he said, "enables Mr. Graham to reach more people with less demands on his time and energy as he gets older. We try to maximize a limited resource that has been blessed by God over the years and try to maximize his effectiveness in his remaining years. Ross was not implying that Billy Graham had gone into semi-retirement and planned to sit at home in Montreat, talking to television cameras and playing out the string. At that time, early in 1988, the team was actively engaged in setting up Mission World, a project that would carry crusades originating in London, Hong Kong, and Buenos Aires to satellite centers in hundreds of cities throughout the world. In underdeveloped nations or away from major cities, the satellite signal would be picked up by low-cost portable receiving dishes that could be transported in a case the size of a golf bag, then unfolded like a fan and made operational in 18 minutes. In more remote spots, the program would be videotaped and shown in small villages a day or two later on portable VCR equipment. Mr. Graham is not afraid of the technology at all, Ted Dienert insisted. He welcomes it. He wants God to use him until it is all over, and he is willing to take the necessary risks. It would be easy for him to stay in the same pattern, but he is a visionary man, and I feel that God has really honored that. Dienert had good reason to appreciate his father-in-law. BGEA was unusual among large independent ministries, and having continued to use an outside agency rather than creating an in-house agency that would perform the same roles without receiving the 15% to 17% commissions typically paid to agencies for their work. The savings were substantial. For example, if an agency receiving a 15% commission bought $20 million in television airtime, its share was $3 million. Fred Dienert, who prospered handsomely from the arrangement, saw it as a mark of Graham's character that he remained with Bennett. Bill remembers his friends, he said. He's very faithful to his friends, and he's been faithful to us. He could have gone in-house a long time ago, but he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to be bothered with it. He has enough problems as it is, and he's happy with what we've been doing, and he appreciates it. Not everyone within BGEA was completely at ease with the arrangement. Overt criticism was muted, or ventured on a not-for-attribution basis, in part because Fred Dienert had been connected with the ministry for longer than all but the inner circle, in part because Millie Dienert, who received no pay for her extensive work in building the prayer program, was held in unfailingly high regard. In part because Bennett Company personnel unquestionably did a first-rate job and appeared genuinely committed to the ministry's primary goals. And in part because Ted Dienert was married to the Graham's youngest daughter, Bunny. Still, an undercurrent of uneasiness occasionally bubbled to the surface. Ask where Fred Dienert could be found. A plainly dressed Graham lieutenant might name a location, then add, "You'll be able to spot him." A mild dig at Dienert's preference for somewhat flashier clothes than were common in BGEA. Another would commend Franklin Graham for living in just an ordinary house with a tin roof and driving a car just like yours or mine, not a Porsche like some people drive. Again, the reference was clear. BGEA salaries would not support a lifestyle that includes Porsches, airplanes, and Arabian horses. Ted and Bunny Dienert somehow managed to have them all. When the only issue was standard payment for work well done, few people seemed to have objected, though when Walter Bennett died in 1982, some board members reportedly suggested it might be time to form an in-house agency under the direction of Cliff Barrows. Those vague feelings of discontent were reinforced when Ted Dienert, who had worked on the Graham account since 1967, took charge of producing the TV programs that same year, giving rise to inevitable murmurs of nepotism. In 1987, however, the Dienerts found themselves at the center of a small stir that illustrated both a constant need to monitor the ministry's financial affairs and a willingness to take swift and decisive action when the situation demanded it. For several years, post-production work, final editing and preparation for duplication on the television programs had been done at CBS, a video facility in Dallas, where the Bennett Company's main headquarters are located. In 1986, however, the contract was shifted to Third Coast Studios, a small operation in Austin. Some board members questioned the shift and wondered why Third Coast had been selected without competitive bidding. When the answer came to light, it was not inspiring. early in October 1987 when asked about ties between Third Coast and the Bennett Company. Fred Dienert acknowledged that we are related. We have a small portion. CVS, he explained, had not always been able to get the post-production work done as rapidly as was needed. Owning a small portion of Third Coast provided enough leverage to make certain the turnaround time for production was minimal. What Dienert characterized as a small portion turned out to be 45%, with an additional 5% belonging to a Bennett employee. When Cliff Barrows learned the extent of Bennett's ownership, he is said, in suitably evangelical language, to have hit the ceiling. In a year when the biggest story in American religion was the fall of Jim Baker's PTL empire, the one major ministry that had managed to emerge as a model of probity did not need a revelation that Billy Graham's son-in-law and one of his oldest friends not only benefited handsomely from handling his media account, but had also hired their own company to help produce his programs. It was neither illegal nor more expensive than the arrangement with CVS, and it may have been efficient, but it could easily cast Graham and his ministry in an unfavorable light if zealous reporters got hold of the information. Almost immediately, while Ted Dienert was in Austin supervising work on programs drawn from Graham's Denver Crusade, Barrows flew in for a brief but intense set of discussions. No one would speak freely about the details of their conversations, and it is not clear Barrows knew precisely what he was looking for when he arrived, but the upshot was unambiguous. Within days, the post-production contract was shifted back to CVS. Not long afterward, Graham's board appointed one of its members to serve as a special liaison between BGEA and the Bennett Agency to make certain their financial relationships remained well within ethically defensible limits. Chapter 34. Decently and in Order. The swift end to which Cliff Barrows brought the ambiguous operation in Austin was not simply the product of one man's determination to follow the scriptural injunction to abstain from all appearance of evil, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 22. Rather, it reflected the conscious and remarkably well-observed philosophy that permeated another key foundation stone in Billy Graham's enduring success, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association itself. Graham was quick to admit that his ability to travel the world, to stand before great throngs, to send his words to the farthest reaches of the planet, to visit and befriend the famous and powerful, to influence the policies of great nations, and to raise up legions to take his place, were enormously enhanced by the tireless and dedicated efforts of several hundred men and women who labored in quiet anonymity in downtown Minneapolis. For nearly 40 years, from 1950 until he reluctantly went into semi-retirement in 1987, George Wilson ran BGEA's headquarters with an iron hand. A stout, squarish man with a bulldog face and a taste for iridescent suits and sports coats that clash with the kindly pastor image of most BGEA staff members, Wilson enjoyed the respect, if not always the affection, of those who labored in his vineyard. One team member characterized Wilson as having a unique gift for giving directions. From a position of greater occupational security, Billy Graham put it more pointedly. George is a dictator. Maybe I shouldn't use that word, but he's a strong man. He doesn't mind telling somebody off if they need telling off. He's not the most popular man in the world, but he does use Sunday school language, and he's a real Christian. He's part preacher, part lawyer, part financial wizard. A former staffer cited frustration with Wilson as a major reason he had left the organization. He's hard to deal with, he explained. He deals carefully, particularly when he doesn't know how close someone is to Billy, because he doesn't want direct competition. He deals by instinct and little more, and he can throw cold water on any idea. But even he acknowledged Wilson's effectiveness. George knows how everything is wired. He's like an indispensable engineer. To a considerable extent, what aggravated Wilson's detractors was his zealous concern for the bottom line. That near obsession with saving money, however, helped shield Graham from the kind of criticism heaped on evangelists who live in opulent mansions, drive fleets of luxury automobiles, and air-condition their doghouses. BGEA's Minneapolis complex, comprising an old and unremarkable three-story office building purchased from Standard Oil, and a newer structure that was once a parking garage for the Willys Overland Automobile Company, had a Spartan quality that made it easy to believe the association obtained it for only $2.25 per square foot. In contrast to the elaborate and sometimes garish personal monuments erected by other media ministers, it could easily pass for the regional headquarters of a medium-sized insurance company. And were it not associated with Billy Graham, it would surely not have been a stop on the Chamber of Commerce tour of the city. But as he walked through it, George Wilson's pride in what he had built and in the money he had saved in building it was unmistakable. The lifeline of every major independent ministry is its direct mail operation. Howard Pugh, Maxie Jarman, and other members of BGEA's board provided major funding for several large projects. But the bulk of the ministry's support comes in small bills and modest checks, tucked into the millions of letters that pour into the headquarters, 140,000 to 150,000 during a normal week, twice that per day during the quarterly television broadcasts. With multiplied millions of letters involved, minuscule savings per unit quickly become substantial amounts. No one understood that better than George Wilson, and he loved to show off procedural shortcuts or mechanical gimmicks he had devised to save money for the association. Pausing to give some whirring apparatus an affectionate pat, like a coach commending a running back, he observed, "This saves about a half a penny a letter. When you're talking about millions of checks a year, it's worthwhile." Then cocked his head as if to say, "What do you think of that?" Officially, Wilson stepped down from his post as BGEA's Chief of Operations in 1987, but he continued to work full-time as a consultant on various projects. Fortunately for the organization, any reluctance he felt about moving out of the top spot was eased by his having a major role in picking his successor, John Quartz. Like Graham, Quartz attended Florida Bible Institute, and he worked with YFC for years before signing on to help with the 1964 Boston Crusade. Intending to stay with the association only 6 months, he wound up staying 16 years until he resigned to take a pastorate in 1980. Following a successful run in a local church, he moved into the presidency of his alma mater, now known as Trinity College and located in Dunedin, Florida. But Graham was reluctant to let him go. After obtaining leaves of absence to take key roles in both Amsterdam conferences, where he showed unusual administrative competence, Quartz finally agreed to take over the reins of BGEA. It appears to have been a happy choice. He was sufficiently tough, but less prickly and protective than Wilson, and he clearly had the boss's confidence. "George picked him," Graham reported, "and that helps. Whoever sits in that office is sort of the main center of the thing." The executive committee and the board call the ultimate shots, but it's that day-by-day running of it that sets the tone. John's a man of the Scriptures. He loves the Lord, and he will keep the organization on a firm biblical keel, and that's what I want. It is difficult to imagine that any visitor to BGEA headquarters in Minneapolis would have failed to notice a distinctive atmosphere. It was simple enough to dismiss almost universal participation in 10-minute daily devotionals and twice-weekly chapel services as prudent conformity. But casual conversation and consistent behavior quickly dispelled suspicions that this was just another job for these folk. At lunch, the cafeteria resembled a fellowship dinner at a middle-sized Midwestern church with little attention to distinctions of rank. Quartz sat and talked easily with a minor official secretary and a man from the art department. And nearby, a printer and the head of the estate planning division speculated about why even the most vigorous churches seemed to be having trouble drawing a good crowd for Wednesday night prayer meetings. It was no surprise to hear several people observe that we're really more like a family than a business, but the easy analogy was not far off the mark. Watching Billy Graham interact with BGEA personnel made it clear that, though he depended heavily on men like George Wilson and John Quartz, he was no figurehead who simply showed up at press conferences or popped into the pulpit to do whatever his handlers told him to do. No one doubted he was the undisputed leader of his team, and that both the strengths and shortcomings of his leadership style left indelible marks on the association. Those who worked with him for years uniformly praised his vision, his intuition, his sense of strategy, and his ability to choose people he could trust and to motivate them to put his dreams into operation. "He is much brighter than most people, including himself, give him credit for being," John Akers insisted. "He may not quote Aquinas in Latin, but he sees the essence of a problem quicker than most people. He has an ability to intuit the heart of a problem that is sometimes a little short of brilliant." George Wilson, who preferred performance to pedigree, made a similar assessment. "He has innate common sense. That's something you don't get with a PhD. When he gets the facts, he can usually come up with the right decision." Sometimes the decision-making process was more calculating than it might appear on the surface. "He plays it down," T.W. Wilson said, "but he's a real administrator. Many times he has shared with me in private what he thinks ought to be done. Then, in a meeting with the board, he will ask someone, 'What do you think?' Then he'll look at another one and ask, 'What do you think?' When he gathers all their comments, he will say, 'Well, I think most of us would agree that this is what we ought to do.' And it will be exactly what he had been planning to do all along. His timing is almost as good as his strategy." One of Graham's greatest gifts was his ability to gather and hold on to a collection of men and women who proved to be far more able than any objective analysis of their portfolio would have predicted. As Sterling Houston diplomatically phrased it, "Mr. Graham has a remarkable ability to respond to intuitive promptings." Further, once he had chosen someone, Graham accorded a remarkable amount of trust. "Billy is a great delegator," T.W. Wilson observed. "He gives you a job, and he trusts you to get it done. He doesn't stand over your shoulder and monitor what you're doing, but he expects you to do the job and do it right. He doesn't want you to tell him, 'I can't.' He'll say, 'You keep working at it. If you want to, you can tell me how you accomplished it when you get it done.' At the same time, he's a good forgiver. He forgives all of us our mistakes." Graham was also extraordinarily generous with praise toward those who worked with him. Alan Emery, who took early retirement in 1978 to devote full time to serving as BGEA's unpaid president, observed that he has one of those rare qualities that the greatest of leaders have, being able to share the glory. He always shares the reward publicly. He never stints in the praise he gives anyone. It has to be earned to a degree, but he's very generous with it. Sometimes I think he goes a little overboard. The obverse side of Graham's willingness to let his underlings work without specific direction was his own resistance to being pinned down on the details of whatever it was he wanted to do. One former associate described BGEA operations, particularly those directly involving Graham, as more process than structure. "Plans are made and unmade all the time. The inside circle tries to anticipate his movements, and there is some manipulation. They know what he responds to, but he tries to keep all his options open. It is hard to tie him down on anything. You can never get him to say yes or no. If you ask him to do something, he's apt to say yes, but that doesn't mean he will do it. He doesn't want to commit because something else might come up. An important meeting or a TV show or something like that. He is the inspiration and the mover, but he is also the bottleneck." T.W. Wilson, who laughingly admitted to having to buy several sets of plane tickets for any trip Graham made, put a more positive face on Graham's resistance to being pinned down. "How can you be in God's will and pray for his leadership if you've already got a fixed idea about what you're going to do? The very fact that he's willing to change, that he's flexible, that's because he always seeks God's guidance. And he does that with his schedule. If there's a part of the world where he feels God is impressing him to go, he'll postpone something and go." Wilson's theological gloss on Graham's notorious flexibility would not have displeased the boss. "Recalling that a lot of times I would go into a city to help prepare for a crusade, and he wouldn't even know where I was for a year." Robert Firm once faced Graham with the frustrations his open-ended way of operating generated in his staff. "It would help all of us," Firm told him, "if you would be more specific as to what you want us to do." Graham hesitated not a moment. "When God called me to the work of evangelism," he shot back, "I had to realize that it's only the Holy Spirit that can give the answer to questions. And if that same Holy Spirit can't guide you, you'll know it yourself, and you'll probably drop off the team. But don't expect me to tell you what to do." Firm smiled at the memory. "That was a definite point of view of his," he said. "I only brought it up that one time." Graham relied heavily on his board of directors, an all-too-familiar pattern in independent evangelistic ministries has been for the ministry's board, which is required for the ministry to qualify as a non-profit tax-free organization, to consist of the evangelist, his wife, son, son-in-law, brother-in-law, closest assistant, lawyer, and one or two ciphers. In such an arrangement, the chances for financial and ethical laxity are enormous. Perhaps no single organizational measure Billy Graham took did more to keep him out of hot water and to undergird his reputation for fiscal integrity than his recruitment of and submission to an impressively strong board. Graham, Cliff Barrows, T.W. Wilson, George Wilson, and Franklin Graham were all on the board, as were Evie Hill and another minister or two, but they were surrounded by such successful Christian business and professional men as CEOs Robert Van Kampen, William Walton, Holiday Inns, Bill Mead, Campbell Taggart Industries, Bill Pollard, Service Master, Carlos Morris, Stewart Title Company, Frank Coy, Day Company Department Stores in Cleveland, Montgomery Advertiser editor and publisher Harold Martin, former Minnesota Governor Harold Levander, financial manager and former Harvard University Corporation Treasurer George Bennett, Dallas banking executives Bill Shea and Dewey Presley, and former Postmaster General Marvin Watson. The larger board, which stood at 27 in 1990, had final jurisdiction, but much of the real work of oversight was performed by a 9-member executive committee chaired by Alan Emery. This committee met approximately 10 times a year in person and convened on the telephone as needed. Neither Graham nor any other person paid by the association or in a position to benefit financially from any of its operations served on the executive committee. "That board has people on it," Ed Plowman observed, "who are not accustomed to having someone walk in, as some well-known evangelists do, and say, 'Here is the way we're going to go.' They took what Billy said seriously, but not as a blank check they would sign without examination, and they took a much stronger stand in later years than they used to. The board would definitely call his hand on certain things. 'Who gave you authority to do that?' 'We have a budget here, and we have to stick with it. That happens.'" George Bennett, the former Harvard treasurer, agreed. "I have served on many boards," he noted, "but I have never been associated with an organization that has such high standards of business procedure and financial controls as BGEA. Graham's handling of his personal finances long reflected this same concern for propriety. Since he made the decision in 1952 to accept a specified salary instead of the much higher love offerings he could have reaped from his crusades, he and his board agreed that the benchmark for his wage would be the salary earned by a prominent minister in a large urban church. At the time, the figure was approximately $15,000. And when money was tight, as during both the Marathon 1954 London Crusade and the Madison Square Garden campaign in 1957, both Graham and his team took half salary to keep expenses down. By the late 1980s, BGA's income was running over $70 million a year, and the evangelist's salary had risen to nearly $80,000, a figure he readily acknowledged to be an imprecise gauge of his true financial status, both because many of his expenses when he was away from Montreat were either paid for by the association or picked up by friends and supporters, and because of the huge royalties his books earned. Still, repeated efforts of reporters and other Graham watchers failed to turn up any of the usual signs of great personal wealth or evidence that he was squirreling away stockpiles of money to squander during some long postponed rainy season. His mountain home is worth perhaps $500,000 today, but more for the 150 acres it sits on than for the log and asbestos siding structure itself. It is unquestionably a marvelous dwelling, but that is due more to Ruth Graham's taste and ingenuity than to any obvious outlay of money. Graham stopped accepting free clothes during the 1960s, but did not follow a rigid policy of refusing all gifts. When he played golf regularly, he paid for membership in the Black Mountain and Biltmore Country Clubs, both near Asheville. But his membership at Grandfather Mountain, another North Carolina club, was paid for by the developer, and Jack Nicklaus gave him a membership at John's Island Country Club in Vero Beach, Florida. He long accepted free rooms at Marriott hotels and Holiday Inns, and was often the guest of admiring hoteliers in Crusade cities. He defended this practice by pointing out that there's nothing in the Bible that says I can't accept freebies. But he routinely turned down ultra-luxurious accommodations to avoid creating an impression that might harm his ministry. Fending off generous well-wishers could be difficult. June Carter Cash, after watching Ruth shiver on a crusade platform one evening, presented her with a full-length hooded mink coat. Ruth told June she could not even appear in public wearing such an obviously expensive coat, much less on a crusade platform. June told her to wear it to the barn, wear it in the car, wear it out walking with Billy in the snow on the mountain, but stay warm. She followed that directive for a while, using the coat as an everyday wrap, once showing up at a friend's house with asbestos gloves as accessories, but eventually got June's permission to donate it to a charity auction. Friends who knew what she had done, however, bought it for twice its true value and gave it back to her, with strict instructions that she not try to get rid of it again. In similar fashion, Billy turned down the offer of several board members to provide him with a corporate jet, with all expenses paid for 5 years. Ruth and I couldn't sleep for thinking about it, he recalled. We just felt BGEA couldn't have an airplane. If he so chose, Graham could have easily amassed considerable wealth from honoraria for speeches and royalties from his books, virtually all of which had been bestsellers. He received thousands of invitations to speak each year, many with the promise of large fees, but he turned down most and took no honoraria for those he accepted. Since 1960, all his royalties went into a general trust administered by the First Union National Bank in Charlotte, which dispersed it to facets of his ministry or to other charities. Much of more than $1 million earned by angels, for example, went to the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton. The royalties from Approaching Hoofbeats, which sold over 500,000 copies, helped pay for the follow-up after Amsterdam 83. He explained that he had the right to make an exception and hold out a portion of the money each year, but said in 1989, "I've only done it once, and that was this last year, because Ruth and I felt we just had to have some extra money coming in. We had to help some of our children and grandchildren a little bit, especially with the education of grandchildren." Then, quite accurately, he added, "Of course, I could have kept it all." The Grahams' tastes were far from exotic or expensive. At home, they had a housekeeper, but Ruth did most of the cooking herself, and the fare was delicious but absolutely unpretentious. Homemade soup, pounded steak or leftover ham, turnip greens, and creamed corn, and marvelous made-from-scratch biscuits. But Billy didn't require even that level of preparation. "If I'm not here," she said, "his favorite meal is baked beans, Vienna sausages, and canned tomatoes. Can you think of anything worse? They're all the same color, for one thing." He chuckled at his own plebeian preferences, adding, "I share the beans with the dogs." None of it seemed to be an act. In an early conversation over club sandwiches in a New York hotel room, he explained that he seldom went out to restaurants because constant interruptions from well-meaning admirers made it difficult to finish a meal. He had made a rare exception the night before. Fred Dienert loves to go out to real nice restaurants, so he just insisted we go to Trader Vic's. Graham's personal offices in both Minneapolis and Montreat served as an index of his attitude toward vulgar display. The Minneapolis office, which he seldom used, was extremely modest, smaller than several in the same area, and it opened directly onto a large warren of modular action offices, filled with secretaries and middle-level managers. Its simple furnishings and few pictures conveyed no sense that it belonged to the central figure in the organization, and staff members felt little hesitation at saying, Why don't you just work in Mr. Graham's office? Nobody's using it today. His office at the Montreat headquarters was larger, but scarcely more opulent. Were it not for several family photographs and a copper plaque bearing a likeness of L. Nelson Bell, few would suspect its occupant's identity. Team members generally followed Graham's example of frugality. Their modest middle-class homes gave no hint they were occupied by world travelers. Cliff and Billy Barrows, for example, live in a thoroughly pleasant wooden home on a hilltop on the edge of Greenville, South Carolina. The view from the kitchen window is lovely, and the house is large enough to have reared 5 children comfortably, but it lacks any sign of ostentation. A few feet away stands a small cabin that houses offices for Barrows, his associate Johnny Lenning, and their secretary. It also contains a tiny studio, where Cliff and Lenning produce the Hour of Decision broadcasts. The two men built the cabin themselves, and BGEA paid no rental for its use. Barrows paid a yard man out of his own pocket, but he and his 2 co-workers handled the janitorial duties themselves. He did not seem to count it remarkable that the most popular religious radio program in history was put together in a little wooden building in his backyard. "That's just one of the phases of our job," he said with a shrug, "a very small part." Graham and his associates clearly felt that reliance on a strong board invested with real authority was a major factor in protecting him from the scandals that rocked the world of television evangelism in the late 1980s. "I don't think Jim Baker intended to do those things," George Wilson observed. "He just slid into it. He didn't have anybody around to tell him it was wrong. I don't think he started out to be dishonest. Billy knows that any man has feet of clay and had better mind his steps." Precisely because neither Graham nor his lieutenants felt immune to temptation, they consistently stressed the need for help in keeping a check on their baser inclinations. Millie Dienert volunteered that, "I've always appreciated, from a moral point of view, how clean the men have been in their attitude toward the secretaries. The doors are always left open. There's a high regard for the lack of any kind of privacy where a boss and his secretary are involved. At times, I thought they were going a little too far, that it wasn't necessary. But I'm glad they did it, especially today. They have kept everything above reproach. When you're working on a long-term basis with the same person, constantly, in hotels, where the wife is not there and the secretary is, that is a highly explosive situation. You have to take precautions. I've always respected the way they've handled that. It's been beautifully done." Graham himself lamented the tribulations Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, and Oral Roberts had brought on themselves by illegal, immoral, and outrageous behavior. "I've prayed for them a lot," he said. And he seemed to mean it. He maintained positive feelings about his old friend Oral Roberts, but acknowledged substantial misgivings about some of the directions Roberts had taken in later years. "Oral invited me to give the dedication speech at the City of Faith. He also invited Gene Mayberry from the Mayo Clinic. I called Gene to ask him what he was going to do, and he said he was waiting to see what I was going to do, because his colleagues didn't think he should lend the prestige of the Mayo Clinic to Oral's university. I told Gene I just didn't feel led to go. It was very inconvenient for me. I was supposed to be in Dallas that day for a Billy Graham day at the First Baptist Church, but there was also something in my heart that said, don't go. I love Oral. I believe at times he is a real man of God. At times, though, that tall Jesus and all those other things he said, he talks about things that are just foreign to me. Among all those people, I like Oral best. But when he does things like that, people outside of Christ get very skeptical and cynical." Graham barely knew Baker and Swaggart, and when the scandals broke, he resolutely tried to refrain from making any public comments about their plight. As reporters besieged him with requests for interviews and editors offered him space in their magazines and newspapers, he anguished over what he might say. 40 years ago, he noted in a pained voice, "we took steps to avoid this. But if I say that, I'll come off sounding self-righteous, and I don't want to do that. I may still make some bad mistakes." As much as the debacle saddened him, he was able to see a bright side to the series of seamy episodes. "A couple of big names have crashed," he observed, "but it's like the thousands of flights at O'Hare in Chicago. The overwhelming majority don't crash. We have so many television evangelists doing marvelous work for God. Jesus had just 12 people. One betrayed him, one denied him, one doubted him.